Thanks, Joellen. Thanks, Jed. It's really wonderful here in this, many wonderful things about this congregation. One is the great wealth of musical talent that we do have. So even on a Sunday when the choir, which Joellen also sings, even on the Sunday that they get a day off, we're still blessed with some very wonderful music. So, Sue-El, thank you very much for what you brought to our service today. In 1988, the movie sensation of that year was Rain Man. Really outstanding film, which swept the Oscars, winning Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and for Dustin Hoffman, a Best Actor Award. The other lead actor was Tom Cruise. The storyline, which was very loosely based on a real-life situation in person, was quite captivating. I'm guessing many of you have seen this film, but I'll give it a quick go-over. Tom Cruise plays Charlie Babbitt, a rather self-centered, opportunistic, Los Angeles-based automobile dealer who deals in very high-end type Lamborghini-type cars. He learns that his father, from whom he's been estranged for most of his life, has died at the family home in Cincinnati, leaving a considerable estate, which Cruise's Charlie assumes that he is going to be the inheritor of, thinking that he is his father's only offspring. Upon arriving in Cincinnati, however, he learns that his father's $3 million estate has been given to a mental institution hospital in that city, Cincinnati. Charlie gets his father's antique Buick Roadmaster and some rose bushes. One of the residents at the institution that is the recipient of the elder Babbitt's estate is Raymond Ray Babbitt. That's the character Dustin Hoffman plays. And is the brother of Tom Cruise's Charlie, but a brother that Cruise's Charlie didn't even know that he had. Ray has a rather pronounced case of autism. That's why he's in the hospital there to begin with. Well, in addition to being stunned that he learns to have, that he's got a brother with autism, no less, Charlie also feels he's been cheated out of his share of his father's estate and is determined to get back what he considers to be rightfully his. So his plan is to take Raymond back to Los Angeles to meet with his attorney, to get a court-appointed psychiatrist and see what can be done to recover his share of his father's estate. Charlie wants half of it, the other half going to the hospital in Cincinnati with the understanding that they will maintain and keep custody of his brother for the rest of his brother's life. So the storyline in much of the film, if you've seen this, you know how it goes, is about their cross-country trip, which they take by train because Rainey is afraid of flying. And it's about the relationship that develops between the two brothers as that journey goes on. At first, Charlie treats Raymond as something of a necessary nuisance who's preventing him from what he feels is his share of his father's estate. Charlie is not mean or cruel to Ray. He just wants to get this piece of business taken care of, get what he feels is rightly his, and then get on with his life. Then, when he learns that Raymond has an amazing memory, and that memory can be channeled in specifically directed ways, he teaches his brother how to play blackjack and how to count cards. So they make a stop in Las Vegas where they make a killing at the blackjack tables before getting caught at card counting and sent on their way, albeit considerably richer. For Charlie then, Ray goes from being a nuisance to having a skill that he can exploit. But as their journey goes on, a bond begins to develop. And by the time they get to Los Angeles and meet with the attorney and the court-appointed psychiatrist, Charlie's primary concern has shifted away from the money involved to a genuine care and a genuine concern for his brother. He decides he wants custody of his brother and wants to take care of him if that's what Ray wants. But Ray, in a session with a psychiatrist near the end of the movie, is unable to make that decision. When he's asked if he wants to stay with Charlie, he says yes. But when he's also asked if he wants to go back to the hospital in Cincinnati, he also says yes. Charlie finally decides the most humane thing to do is to have Ray go back to the safety and familiarity of a hospital in Cincinnati and not pursue any further claims against his father's estate. In the last scene in the film, Ray, who is in the company of an aide that Charlie has arranged for, is getting on a train to go back to Cincinnati, Charlie promises he'll be in touch with him and that he'll come and see him in 2 weeks. Where their relationship actually goes is left to the viewer's speculation, because that's the note on which the film ends. Although this movie received largely favorable reviews, it got panned in places for taking what some reviewers took considered to be a patronizing or a romanticized view of the mentally ill and the mentally challenged. And while I guess that case can be made, what I saw in it was the story of someone, Charlie in this case, who was leading a largely self-centered life, coming to see the humanity in someone for whom life had dealt a very different hand. And as he connected with that person, who also happened to be his brother, Charlie discovers his own humanity as well. Reaching out to a brother made him more human. And I guess if you want to take it beyond that, the greater human message in this is that reaching out in whatever ways are available to us, to our brothers and our sisters, especially when they are different from us, does make us all the more human ourselves. Well, while she was hardly living the same kind of life as Tom Cruise's character in Rain Man, the story of Garcia Dix is also that of one who saw the humanity and who saw the dignity in persons whom the society and culture of her day had written off in a kind of wholesale, broad brush way as being untreatably insane, however great or small the degree of mental illness and emotional instability may have been. She's not only a heroine in the annals and the treatment and attitudes towards persons termed mentally ill, she's also a heroine in our faith tradition of Unitarian Universalism. Had the admittedly fictitious Ray Babbitt been living in the United States when Ms. Dix was a young woman, and had he not been from the family of considerable means, as was shown in this movie, he may well have found himself confined to a jail cell instead of the facility he was portrayed as being in. Over the past several years, I've used the fourth Sunday in October as a time to lift up the life and the legacy of a man or a woman from our greater Unitarian or Universalist or UU story. I chose this Sunday because it's the one that is closest to October the 27th, which is 3 days from now. That's the date of the execution by burning at the stake of Michael Servetus in Geneva, Switzerland in 1553 at the behest of John Calvin. The reason for his execution was Servetus' supposed heretical views that rejected the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, but his death was also Calvin's way of establishing himself, establishing his doctrinal credibility, establishing his correctness, as it were, as the titular head of the Protestant Reformation. It was as much a political move on Calvin's part as it had to do with any kind of theology. Servetus, who was a physician and a theologian then, is regarded as the first Unitarian martyr. In a broader sense, he is an example of the use of reason and critical thought in determining one's religious stance. It also points to the danger that such free thinking has put persons in over the course of human history. So as I say, I began this tradition in 2005 with a sermon on Servetus. I decided I would continue it with a UU history sermon ever since on this Sunday. You heard some of Dorothea Dix's story a little earlier in my conversation with the children. You heard some of her own words and the words for reflection that Kathy offered. She was indeed born into impoverished and an abusive family setting up in rural Maine. Her father, Joseph, most likely was an alcoholic, even though he was also an itinerant Methodist preacher. Not quite sure how he held that together, but maybe he did or maybe he didn't. Her mother suffered from a variety of illnesses and was largely an invalid. So Joseph Dix, her father, was, as we also saw, from a family of considerable means. I just think his personal life kind of made him the family outcast or the family ne'er-do-well, which is how he kind of ended up in this little town up in Maine. And young Dorothy, though, had been in touch with her Boston paternal grandparents throughout her life. Her Dix grandfather, whom she dearly loved and rather doted upon her, died when she was 7. The story of how she ran away at age 12 to live with her grandmother in Boston is apparently true, silver dollar and all. And her grandmother did have stern and often harsh ways. Even as she provided for her granddaughter's overall well-being, she also provided for Dorothea's education at a time when such was generally unavailable to young women who were expected to simply marry, raise children, and not much more. And Grandma Dix's severe ways were also reflected in her strong Calvinist beliefs, which were in turn reflected in the church to which Dorothea was sent. As she approached her young adulthood, however, Dorothea discovered Unitarianism. As it was being preached in the 1820s and 1830s from the pulpit of the man regarded as one of the founders of American Unitarianism, Dr. William Ellery Channing. His pulpit was that of the Federal Street Church, now Boston's Arlington Street Church, which sits right there on the corner of Boylston and Arlington Street, if you're familiar with that area. A little side trip here, I wonder what it's like to be the minister of that when the front door of the church is ever open. If you're standing in the pulpit of the Arlington Street Church, looking up the aisle, out the door in the back, the thing you see directly across Arlington Street is the big statue of William Ellery Channing, staring right back at you. Probably wondering if you're keeping the shot. Okay. One of many reasons to keep the doors closed when you're doing a Sunday service. Well, anyway, this was the church then that Dorothea Dix began attending. And in something of a chicken and egg situation, her basic human instincts were nurtured by the liberal Christianity preached by Reverend Channing, which in turn nurtured and heightened those instincts and also served to enhance Dorothea's other many interests in science, literature, and religion. And it was in the preachings and teachings of Channing that she found not a Jesus who had to die an excruciating death to redeem her from an inborn state of depravity, as taught by the Calvinists, but one instead who lived a life of love and service and compassion and called upon human beings to do the same. She found herself drawn to the early 19th century Unitarian belief that salvation is found in emulating the life and the teachings of Jesus rather than being dependent upon his death to save one from the curse of original sin. Even at the age of 14, as we also saw, Dorothea was able to convince her grandmother to allow a part of the Dix mansion to be used as a school for impoverished children. Remember, there were no public schools in those days. If you could afford to send your child to school, they got an education. If they didn't, you didn't. Now, Dorothea was already in fragile health, as her mother had been, to the point that first her grandmother didn't want to do it. Then she saw that Dorothea was in very failing health. She may have acceded to her wishes, figuring that perhaps her granddaughter might not be long for this world anyway. But she persevered for a time. But in the long run, Grandma was almost right. For even as Dorothea worked tirelessly at her school for the indigent and wrote books for children, her health continued to fail to the point that when she got to be 32 years old, she had a complete physical, emotional breakdown. She did catch tuberculosis. And through some of Reverend Channing's contacts, she was sent to England to recover under the care of a couple who were especially adept in caring and treating persons with both physical and emotional difficulties and challenges. So she came back to Boston, her physical health restored, and she had her life-defining moment when she was 39 years old. By this time, she had already turned down an invitation of marriage, choosing to devote all of her energies instead to the causes in which she believed. Given, again, the status of women at that time, you chose marriage, that kind of defined your life going in one direction. Dorothea decided that was not where she wanted to go. So, as I also said in my story with the children, 1841, 39 years old, She's asked by the people at the Arlington Street Church if she could lead a Bible study class at the Cambridge for women at a prison in Cambridge. And it was here she discovered, to her horror, the mentally ill persons, from the severe to the less than severe, were being thrown into prison with criminals, also from the severe to the less than severe, and they were being treated in all manner of inhumane ways. As I say, that became her defining moment. That was the cause to which she devoted nearly all of the remaining 46 years of her life. With Channing's help, she enlisted the help of fellow Boston Unitarians and fellow members of the church there, Samuel Gridley Howe, husband of Julia Ward Howe, who founded the Perkins School for the Blind, and also Horace Mann, who did come to make, was instrumental in making public education available in America. Her efforts at the time went well beyond Boston. She traveled throughout New England, throughout the South, advocating for legislation to build mental hospitals for the mentally ill. You heard a piece of the testimony when she got to Kentucky. In the first 7 years, from experience in Cambridge, she traveled 60,000 miles, visited numerous existing mental institutions, attended a groundbreaking for the ones that she had helped get going with the help of various state legislative bodies. I would imagine that the nature of the treatment methods used in the hospitals that Dorothea Dix originally helped to establish would be considered quite lacking by today's standards, but they were remarkable steps forward in the mid-19th century. In time, she took her crusade to the federal level. She convinced both houses of Congress to pass a bill that would have created a perpetual fund to continue to support efforts to help the mentally ill, and would have set aside millions of acres of land for their treatment as well. Her greatest disappointment was when President Franklin Pierce, New Hampshire's only president, vetoed the bill, declaring that such expenditures were not the rightful purview of the federal government. Or perhaps he just didn't want any part of any kind of government-run health care. Yeah. During the Civil War, During the Civil War, Ms. Dix organized an Army nursing corps of female volunteers. She was given a commission as superintendent of U.S. Army nurses as she approached the age of 60. Well, the thing I find most remarkable, a lot of stuff I find remarkable about this woman, very quiet, low-key woman's life, was that she was doing what she did at a time when women not only didn't have the vote, but were not expected, indeed they were discouraged, from having any kind of role, any kind of voice in the shaping of any kind of public policy. That was considered men's work. My sermon 1 year ago on this Sunday was on Dr. Benjamin Rush, a Philadelphia-based universalist, early shaper of American universalism, and the man regarded as the father of American psychiatry. Now, Benjamin Rush was a very well-connected man, prestige, learning, political power. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. And as much as I admired his life, I find it all the more admirable of Dorothea Dix that a woman without the kind of societal and political clout that a man like Dr. Rush had was, in effect, his peer when it came to promoting mental health reform in this country. Dorothea Dix died in Trenton, New Jersey, at the age of 85. She had been given an apartment on the grounds of the New Jersey State Hospital, which was one of the very first institutions she had been instrumental in founding in the earlier days of her reform efforts. She called that institution her firstborn child. Having no children of her own, she considered the hospitals that she helped to establish as being her offspring. Well, her legacy is one still in the process of being fulfilled today when it comes to our attitudes and our treatment of mentally ill persons. And I'm quite aware that the term mentally ill covers a very wide range of behaviors and conditions. There's a lot that kind of gets tucked under that. And while, as I already noted, the treatment methods of Dr. Rush and the types of institutionalization for which Ms. Dix advocated would very likely be considered lacking by today's standards, they were certainly pioneers in their day. And among the prejudices they had to deal with was a religiously based notion that persons dealing with any kind of mental illness were doing so because they had found disfavor from God, and they were being condemned or punished by God in some way for some kind of personal weakness. That was part of the cultural attitude that they were both dealing with as their efforts went forward. Well, I feel my predecessor in this pulpit, our minister emeritus, the late Reverend Donald Rowley, he was certainly standing in the tradition of the Unitarian Dorothea Dix and the Universalist Benjamin Rush when he played an instrumental role in this community in establishing both Community Council and Harbor Homes. Lee, delighted to see you here this morning. I know you, Lee Page, played a role in that as well. Welcome today. As these two fine organizations demonstrate, the treatment of mentally ill or mentally and emotionally challenged persons is now moving away from institutionalization. And as positive a move as I believe this is, there still remains, or probably always will be, the need for the kind of hospitals, the kind of institutions in the 21st century version for which Ms. Dix advocated and fought. Just a couple quick more points before I close here. For all the advances that have been made in the treatment of mentally ill or emotionally disturbed persons, I know that practically any family who has ever had to deal with some of the more mild to some of the more severe forms of mental illness. Know what a stress, know what a strain that can put on the whole family system. I think when we become aware of those situations, the best thing we can do is be as loving and caring to families in those situations as we can. Within our congregational family, this past year, as many of you know, we found ourselves dealing on more than one occasion with the tragically extreme and painful outcomes of chronic depression, resulting in persons taking their own lives. Even to this day, we cannot be fully aware of the extent of the mental and emotional turmoil some of those even closest to us experience. And for persons in the midst of those experiences, and sometimes in the aftermath of some of the tragedies we experienced here in recent months, I think really all we can do is love one another, be kind to ourselves, and continue to be as best we can bearers of compassion and understanding. Moving quickly on, even as I strongly support the granting of the most appropriate levels of personal autonomy to persons with mental and emotional maladies, I'm also, again, aware of how the refusal of treatment, including medication, can push those family stresses to which I was already referring to very high levels. I think it's very healthy. I think it's a good thing that we have moved from a time when, as in Ms. Dixon's letter, mentally ill persons have practically no personal autonomy at all, to a time now when autonomy for those persons is given a very high priority. And the real challenge is finding the right and the most just balance between mandated treatment and personal choice on the part of the mentally ill. That's an ongoing challenge. It's an ongoing struggle. And sometimes the results don't always come out the way we would like as we try to strike that balance. But however one feels about how that balance is properly struck between autonomy and how much autonomy can be granted, I still say we have Dorothy Dix, along with Benjamin Rush, to thank for getting the conversation to the point where it now is. This woman and this man from our Unitarian and Universalist faith traditions certainly still merit our praise today. And finally, I see in the life and the dedication of Dorothy Dix yet another example of how one's religious convictions can inform and direct a person's living a life of devoted, and in Ms. Dix's case, a life of passionate service to one's fellow human beings. She has shown what it means to be a passionate advocate for social justice for the sake of the greater human good. And I do know that the case can be well made, has been well made, as to how religion has been and continues to be a force or an instigator of all manner of human misdeeds and evil and ignorance. And I don't contest that case at all. I only say that such a case is only half of the equation at best. For what I see in the life of a woman like Dorothea Dix and others like her is that of a well-educated and deeply dedicated humanitarian, a strong advocate for a particular kind of social justice, who is also a very devout religious person. For when she reached for what she regarded as the ultimate motivation for how she lived and dedicated her life, it was found in the image of the loving and compassionate Jesus she heard preached from the Unitarian pulpits of her day. And I would say the message from her life to ours is not that we necessarily embrace her type of religion, but that we continue to explore and dig ever more deeply into our own lives as well, as we seek out the most authentic and the most caring and the most loving ways that we can live our lives. For this indeed is one of the many